Well, our turkey is in the oven. We've also heard now how to cook it properly. So let's look at one of the other trappings of Christmas, and that's Christmas trees. They're interesting plants because they are evergreens. So let's find out a bit more about them from Beverly Glover. She's the director of Cambridge University's Botanic Gardens. So, Beverly, first of all, what do we actually mean by the word evergreen? Are things that are evergreen really always green?
Well, they do keep their leaves all year round, Chris, so that's what we mean. They might drop a leaf off from time to time when that leaf's old and past its lifespan, but there'll always be green leaves photosynthesising on that tree.
And how did the two different types of tree come about, the ones that do drop their leaves and the ones that don't?
Well, actually, I think there are three different types of trees, because there are two different types of being evergreen. So if you start at the tropics and think about trees there, they're evergreen. They can photosynthesise all year round. There's always lots of sun. It's warm. Everything's great. As you move north in the northern hemisphere or south in the southern hemisphere, you reach an area like Britain where it's a bit cold and miserable in the winter. You're not going to get much photosynthesis done. There's not much light. And your leaves become a big risk because if it's windy, they create a big surface area. And so having a deciduous habit where you drop those leaves starts to become evolutionarily sensible. It's a good adaptation to survive the winter by dropping your leaves and regrowing them in the spring. But if you carry on north in the northern hemisphere or south in the southern hemisphere, you reach a point where the growing season is so short that actually regrowing new leaves each spring in order to photosynthesize wouldn't make sense. And there's an added double whammy in there, which is that the soil temperature is so cold that there's not much fungus around, it's hard for leaves to break down, and there's not much mineral nutrient available in the soil. And so for those trees, there really isn't time and energy and resource to build new leaves each year. And so they have to go back to the evergreen habit that the tropical trees had.
So which came first then in evolution? Did the trees that had leaves all year round come first, and then they turned into evergreens over evolutionary time? Or were there evergreen-type plants first, and they turned into deciduous trees?
That's a difficult question, because what we now see as trees aren't the first trees that we would have seen in evolutionary time. So ferns and some plants called lycophytes, which are now just little tiny things, 30, 40 centimetres tall, used to be the trees that we had before we had the current seed plants. And those trees would have been evergreen. They were mostly tropical. And then as the trees started to spread out in the Permian into colder and drier areas, then they started to form these deciduous habits. And then again, the new evergreen forms evolved.
What's interesting, though, is that the trees that do drop leaves tend to have big flat leaves, whereas the evergreens, like Christmas trees, have gone for needles. So are needles effectively just modified leaves? And if so, why are they like that?
Yeah, so that's exactly what needles are. And they definitely evolve at a point in evolutionary history where the world gets colder and drier. So the needle form is about protecting yourself against two things. One, against a big surface area that the winds can blow through and potentially pull the whole tree over. But secondly, against water loss. So you're minimising the surface area of the leaf. The stomata, the pores through which the plant breathes and loses water, are held in channels, usually along the needles. And so they're sort of below the level of the leaf surface. And that reduces the amount of water that's sucked out of them. So it's all an adaptation to retain water and to not get blown over in a cold, dry habitat.
And do the plants do anything else to tolerate extremes of temperature? Because a lot of these evergreens grow in places, as you've pointed out, where it's really, really cold for part of the year.
Yeah, so lots of plants have different antifreeze type defences. They'll have cold tolerant proteins that they express when the temperature is particularly cold. That changes the osmotic potential in the vacuole. So that's the big sac of liquid in the middle of a plant cell. Plant cells are very different from an animal cell in having a big bag of water sitting in the middle. And if you change what you put in there, you can change the temperature at which it'll freeze. They also have things like waxes on the surfaces, which give them an added layer of protection against cold and against drying out. So they've got lots of different things going on at different levels.
Other festive plants, for a second, Beverly. So things like holly and that kind of thing. Tell us a bit about them.
Well, holly's a great one because obviously after Christmas lunch, you need to get out in the garden, get some fresh air, and everybody likes a bit of science after lunch.
In your house, perhaps. Our lot want to watch the Queen and pass out.
Surely everyone wants to do some experiments after lunch. If you go find a nice holly bush in the garden and you can set everybody in the family a challenge, count the number of spikes per leaf, 1 foot off the ground, 2 feet off the ground, 3 feet off the ground, you should find statistically significant reduction in spike number per leaf as you go up the plant, which of course is about who's eating those plants. It's an anti-herbivore defence designed to protect the plant against rabbits, small deer, grazers at sort of low level.
Really?
I'm not having you on at all. Go and try it.
How does the plant know how high up each of the leaves is?
Oh, well, that's very clever. And it's not just needles. Arctic willow, for instance, puts some defensive chemicals in its bark just up to the height an Arctic hare can reach if it stands on its back legs and no higher.
But obviously, the part of the plant that is at browsing height when it's growing is quite different than when it's a big mature tree. So is that an acquired thing? As it gets bigger, it starts to put more needles lower down and fewer higher up?
It's quite a long-lived tree, Holly, so it's got time to sort of acclimate as it ages. And there's an element of this which we think is induced in response to where it's been eaten most during its lifetime. But part of it seems to be part of the basic growing design too.
So it's quite literally once bitten, twice shy, or twice spiky.
Exactly. Bet you don't know, Chris, that holly's one of those plants that, like animals, comes in male plants and female plants, whereas most plants, of course, are both. And so if you've got a holly in your garden that never makes berries, it's probably because it's a boy.
Ah, is that the only way to tell?
You can look at the flowers if you know what you're looking for. It's not difficult. You should see four stamens on a male and just one stigma on a female. But the best bet is berries.
So why has it done that then?
Well, it's a bit of an evolutionary dead end, we think. About 4% of flowering plants go down this route. 96% go for the sensible hermaphrodite approach to life. We think they're doing it as an extreme adaptation to prevent self-pollination, self-fertilisation. It's hard for a plant to avoid getting its own pollen on its own stigmas in the flower. This makes absolutely sure you don't. But of course, it also means unless there's another one of you in the same place, then you're not going to reproduce. And since they can't move around, they're reliant on somebody else carrying that pollen for them. That's quite a risky strategy.
It is. And higher up in some trees, especially around here, I've seen quite a lot of it, is mistletoe. How did that get there? And what's special about mistletoe?
It's a hemiparasite, so it does do some photosynthesis, but it doesn't connect into the soil at all. So it gets all its nitrogen, phosphorus from the tree that it's plumbed into. Too much of it, of course, will weaken a tree over time. And it produces those berries at this time of year. And in this country, in the UK, mistletoe is quite an interesting example of climate change because it didn't used to come very far north. It was always a southern England habitat only. And say here in Cambridgeshire, we wouldn't have seen mistletoe 40 years ago. But the berries are spread by blackcaps, a bird that used to not overwinter in the UK, go south to Spain and North Africa for the winter. Now the blackcaps are overwintering. They're eating the berries, spreading them around, and the plant is steadily spreading north across the country with the blackcaps.
So why did people decide they needed to kiss under it?
Well, that's not clear. I mean, it's full of some pretty nasty toxins that'll stop your heart quite quickly. So maybe there's a sinister side effect there.
Kiss of death.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Somebody you don't really fancy, but feel you have to kiss.
No comment, Beverly. Beverly Glover from Cambridge University's Botanic Garden. Thank you very much.